Hey folks, welcome to episode 16 of the Whiskey Ring podcast. My guests for this episode are Paul McLaughlin, Martin Purvis, and William Hornaday, all of Kelvin Cooperage. If you've listened to earlier episodes, you know I've been excited to bring on a cooperage. So much of what we all love about whiskey and other aged spirits comes from the barrel, up to 80%, depending on who you listen to, between color, flavor, body, all of this. But how often do you really think about how that barrel is made? What about who's making them? How are people trained to raise a barrel in just a few minutes? And it's something that can last potentially decades of reuse. Also asking, is toasting a barrel a trend in whiskey or is it here to stay? Because God knows there are a lot of toast-to-barrel releases coming out. All of these questions are asked in this really just fantastic, one-of-a-kind episode. Of course, I left the episode thinking that my questions have been answered. A few weeks later, I've got a page full of them. So Kelvin is the first cooperage on the podcast, but likely not the last. And I really appreciate the guys all taking time from across the country and across the pond to speak with me on the podcast. If you missed it last time around, there's a big announcement via Patreon. You can now support the site and the podcast for as little as $1 a month, plus new and improved benefits for the $2.50 a month and $5 a month tiers, including exclusive content, free glassware after 6 months, and more benefits as the group grows, including things like barrel picks, live events, and I mean, really, the possibilities are endless. Next up, Whiskey Ring Podcast is looking for additional sponsors. If you are a whiskey company, a whiskey accessory company, or a subscription service, or anything related to the industry, reach out to see how you can be a sponsor. There are only going to be 2 more spots opened for sponsorship, so if you're interested, reach out ASAP and we'll start that conversation. You can find Kelvin Cooperage, let's try that one again, you can find Kelvin Cooperage online at kelvincooperage.com and in Louisville, Kentucky. Their socials are also included in the show notes so you can follow them and see the new things happening in the barrel making world. If you haven't yet, please follow Whiskey My Wedding Ring and the Whiskey Ring Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and subscribe to the newsletter at whiskeymywedding.com. If you like what you hear, once again, you can support the site and the podcast for as little as $1 a month through Patreon. Thanks also to our current sponsors, Mash and Grape and Cairn Craft, who are providing discount codes for Whiskey and My Wedding Ring followers and Whiskey Ring podcast listeners. You can subscribe to the Whiskey Ring podcast on your favorite podcast platform today. We are on Podbean, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and most other major podcast platforms. Also, if you can, regardless of which platform you use regularly, take a jump over to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts and leave a 5-star rating and review. It really does help us climb up the charts and just attract more listeners. Every subscription and listen helps us get sponsors, secure guests, and ultimately get more content to you. Thank you for listening and supporting, and please enjoy my chat with Paul, Martin, and William, all of Kelvin Cooperage. All right, welcome everyone to another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by the first cooperage to be joining the show. This is Kelvin Cooperage, and I am joined by 3 gentlemen. I'll let you all introduce yourselves now.
All right, I'm Paul McLaughlin. I'm the owner of Kelvin Cooperage.
I'm William Hornaday, Vice President.
I'm Martin Purvis, Associate Director for Europe.
All right, awesome. Everybody, welcome. Should note that Martin is joining us from Scotland right now.
That's right.
So he's got 5 hours ahead of us. The rest of us are potentially still waking up.
I've had three cups of coffee.
I'm still on my first, so we're good. All right. So as I said, this is the first cooperage that I've had on. It was actually recommended to have you guys on by couple of people, Lou Bryson by Rabbit Hole Distillery.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So, you know, let's start with the basics. You know, I know Kelvin was founded in Scotland originally, moved to the US, but I'd love to hear just brief history of Kelvin and what you guys are like, where you guys are now.
Yeah, so my dad started Kelvin in 1963 in Glasgow in Scotland. He had served his apprenticeship in Glasgow, his four-year apprenticeship in the trade, and then struck out on his own And he ran what is kind of a fairly traditional Scottish cooperage from 1963 up until the early 1990s. So cooperages in Scotland are typically bringing in bourbon barrels for repair to supply to Scottish distilleries, and then working on other various repair, you know, on sherry butts and other barrels that are already in Scotland. So the cooperages there weren't typically making new barrels from scratch. It was a repair operation. In the early 90s, he had kind of the light bulb moment. Why aren't we in Kentucky repair the barrels in Kentucky where they are and then ship only the good stuff to Scotland rather than shipping the bad stuff? So it was kind of a simple idea that then led to the next kind of phase of our cooperage story, which was my elder brother, Kevin, coming out here in the early 90s to Louisville and starting up the cooperage here. So basically continuing that repair operation that we'd done in Scotland. But then when we opened up here, it was right when American oak was starting to be more prevalently used for wine barrels. So we kind of got involved making wine barrels, and that was where we learned how to properly treat and toast oak, and you know what happens when you toast it, and gained some valuable experience making new barrels and learning about the effect of toasting on oak. And we kind of kept plugging away at that. I joined the company in 2001 after swearing for years I'd never joined the family business. And then kind of the next big shift was in like 2010, 11, 12, as the craft distilling boom started happening. We kind of transitioned out of new wine barrels and into making new whiskey barrels, because all of a sudden we had all these craft distilleries coming online that needed oak. And, we were happy to get involved with that. It's something new and different and exciting. So we've gone on that journey with all of our craft distillery clients. So here we are now still doing full service cooperage. So we're still doing the used barrel operation, used barrel repair, the kind of the more traditional supply to Scotland and Ireland and other markets, but then also making new barrels for craft distilleries.
That's nice. And you brought up something very interesting there. So the cooperages in Scotland, I guess I hadn't thought about it, would be more attuned to, breaking down the barrel, used barrels already rather than making new ones. Is that still the case today?
Well, yeah, they're repairing them. They're not breaking them down. So they're barrels that are in the cycle at the distilleries or coming over fresh from the U.S. that might need repair. So yeah, they're not really making any new barrels there, because the proportion of Scotch or Irish whiskey that goes into new barrels is tiny. It's typically only special releases or finishing projects. So most of what is being filled is used cooperage, yeah, from most of that from the U.S.
Gotcha. So first thing I want to ask after that is, so being in Kentucky now and in Louisville, when the company made that shift in the 90s to come over, what did the American oak scene, for lack of a better term, look like as opposed to what it is today? Are there issues of deforestation or anything like that?
If you think back to the 90s, there would be a handful of kind of big legacy bourbon brands. That would be your market for a new whiskey barrel. So there would be relatively few cooperages supplying these distilleries. These distilleries were huge even then. So it was high volume cooperages churning out lots of barrels. I think the wood supply would have been much better then than it is now. There'd be less pressure on the market because there's fewer people needing, looking for barrels. So it was a very different scene. You had a small number of big distilleries. Now we have, approaching 1,000 craft distilleries of all different sizes. So you would back then, you wouldn't have had people needing 10 barrels a month or 20 barrels a month. It was all big volume players.
It's curious, what's a number to throw out there that they would have been requesting a month?
Back then,
yeah.
Yeah, I've no idea. But, you know, now if you think some of the big distilleries are filling 300, 500, 700,000 barrels a year, you know, so that's a lot per day and per week and per month.
Sure, true. So how big's the size of Kelvin, you know, your size of your team?
What do we have, William?
All in, we have about 70 employees right now.
All right, so the hundreds of barrels a day was probably out of the scope, but that allows you then, I would assume, to really focus on those crafts, on the craft guys that you're helping out and creating barrels for.
Yeah, I mean, that's key to what we're doing is, you know, we establish long-term relationships with distilleries that we want to work with and that kind of buy into our concept where we are a bit more craft, a bit more artisan, hands-on. You know, some would say old-fashioned, but we're old-fashioned for a reason because we believe in it, not just for the sake of being old-fashioned, but we think it leads to a better barrel and better flavor profile.
So, you already mentioned, I think, the top topic that I wanted to ask you guys about, which is the toasting in particular.
Yeah.
I didn't think when I first asked you guys to come on the podcast, I was going to talk about a couple of different topics, but since then, four or five different brands have now come out with, or will be coming out with, toasted barrel products.
Yeah.
So aside from the ones that already existed, like Michter's, now you've got, you know, Elijah Craig toasted, Basil Hayden toasted, Barrel, I think I just saw they're toasting a few batches now.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd love to hear what your thoughts, and really everybody's thoughts on what makes toasting different than let's say the heavy char or a char thing, what happens in toasting, and your experience in toasting barrels and what you got from the wine company. I know that's a lot to cover, but I'll just let you guys go on that.
Go for it, William. Yeah.
So it's taking tradition of wine barrel manufacturing where we're using natural white oak fires as opposed to the natural gas, which is what any of the large volume producers are going to be using. So we're taking all the scraps that we generate in the manufacturing process, using those to fuel our fires, and then toasting the barrels before we char them. And so the toasting, the common misconception is that toasting and charring, people maybe think they're the same. Toasting is radiant heat, which, so it's non-direct flame contact. You're setting the barrel over an open flame and letting that heat radiate from the flame into the wood. And that process begins to caramelize sugars and actually convert compounds within the wood that are various forms of sugar chains that you can then break down and activate to become flavor generating components of the barrel. So that toasting process is a 15-20 minute long process that we believe makes all the difference in the quality of the barrel, but it also is a major limiting factor in what you can make in a day if you choose to go about making barrels that way. So it's one of those things that we kind of made that clear decision early on that we were going to be traditional, we were going to make barrels in this way because we believed that process was a better process. And we could fill a niche that wasn't being served by these big cooperages that were just cranking out thousands of barrels a day and using natural gas to char the barrel in 75 seconds and it's out the door. So that's kind of where it came from. It wasn't necessarily that we went out of our way to do it that way. It just worked out that was what made the logical sense at the time for us to stick with the tradition and go after the craft market.
And I'm curious because I know that you mentioned it, but I also know the toasting tradition does come more from the wine side as opposed to the whiskey side. I'm curious why the wine industry would have started toasting the barrels as opposed to using kind of a more either raw or on the other side a charred barrel. And then what might have caused, you know, bourbon or whiskey makers to finally take the plunge?
So with a wine, your big difference is that you're talking about something that maybe has 12% alcohol content versus a whiskey that's going to go in at 100, 125 proof. So you're dealing with two very, very different products. A toasted barrel, you're going to get much more depth of flavor, a whole lot more complexity, much more subtle flavor. And for a wine, those two things marry together very well. If you were to char a wine barrel, you would just end up drinking something that tastes like smoky wood, which I don't think is what people would be looking for in a wine. Yeah. With whiskey, you have this higher proof product, which is going to mask, it's not going to absorb as much of the subtle flavors that a wine would. So, but it will still be impacted by that toast layer. So we're toasting the barrel first to get depth of flavor into the whiskey. But the char, for one, it's legally required for bourbon. You have to char the barrel. But it's also creating an active carbon layer within that barrel. You're essentially building a Brita filter within the barrel. That active carbon is going to scrub and scrub off flavors that might be present in your distillate and help mellow. It's also going to give you that nice amber color that you get, which you will pick up that color from a toast, but not nearly as quickly as you will, and not nearly as depth of flavor or color as you do with the char layer. But I'd like to pass over to Martin too. I think he probably has a lot of insight on.
Yeah, Martin's much more technically inclined than we are.
Yeah.
I think you've done a great job. Like I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I think there's a number of factors at play here. The first one is that spirits, when they're made, tend to have quite a lot of sulfury compounds, which, you know, are immature character. So that char layer for bourbon and for scotch is really critical in terms of the sulfur effectively fixes out the immature sulfury notes and absorbs them over time. So that's critical. You do get a little bit of toast underneath the char, even if you just char alone. But the toast layer is really critical for generating flavor compounds in the wood. And, you know, before I joined Kelvin, I was a big buyer of barrels. I've looked at everybody's processes. The one that Kelvin employ, you can't touch the outside of the barrels when they're being toasted because the heat penetration is so good. And it really does break down the compounds in the wood, which then allows the spirit to extract them. So the degradation products become, you know, vanillin, syringe aldehyde, cyanoaldehyde, these type of products. They're then extracted by the spirit in due course and give incredible flavor and color over time. So that's the process is just incredibly effective at doing that. Whereas, you know, other companies do it more quickly, less heat penetration, less temperature on the outside of the barrel, and just, we don't believe, work as well. So that's my view, both as a buyer and now as I work for the company. It's a key differentiator for us. I think the other point that we would be worth making is that we can dial in everybody's credentials, the right level of char and toast to give 20 or so different options from no toast, no char, which you probably wouldn't want to do, right the way through to fully deep toast and a really heavy char on top. Now, clearly you're going to sacrifice toast layer if you go for a really heavy char on top of a toast, but that's part of the process and people can choose and pick and design a bespoke barrel for themselves. And we, as a company, and the guys have done this for a long time, really love working with small brands and big brands to develop custom projects for these people. So, and you know, they're good liquids. We want to make them even better.
That's awesome. I should ask, I don't remember offhand. I have a stave with me from, but I do not remember which cooperage. Do you guys work with Kings County?
Do not.
No. Okay. That might be ISC. But anyway, so I brought the stave because I wanted to, one, it's just cool to have a stave along with you. But when you toast a barrel, and I'm going to warn you, I like getting like really nitty gritty into the scientific details and the chemical breakdowns and all that. So, you know, stop me if I get too nerdy, but when you're toasting the barrel, obviously it's also going to be opening the wood a little bit more, right? It's going to, just by heat penetration, right? It'll open the pores a little bit more, or
Less so for the toast, but more with the char. So effectively, what the char does is you get that alligator skin type of effect on the inside of a barrel, which creates cracks and opens the pores up more widely than just a toast process. So that then allows spirit to break through the char and actually get right into the toast layer. So that's why, again, we think that our process is more effective at developing mature character.
Gotcha. And perhaps this is more elementary than I'm thinking about it, but is there a reason why you would not char and then toast, as opposed to toasting first and then charring?
I've never thought of it that way. I don't think you would. For one, you wouldn't be able to tell what your toast is doing.
Yeah,
because you would have you already burned the inside of the barrel.
There's a visual aspect of toasting. Yeah. So if you char first, you lose the ability to have that visual,
right,
kind of reference on the toast.
And a smell aspect, right, too. So you would lose that. There's a really crucial smell that we're going for. That's kind of the marzipan-y baked bread, which is the sweet vanillin, the furfural, all that stuff that you really smell on the toast. And I think you would lose your ability to detect that if you charred first.
Yeah, the good analogy is your piece of bread that you put in a toaster. You toast it to the point before it burns, because that's where the flavor comes from. It goes brown, you break down the sugars, it tastes nice, it tastes better than just a piece of bread. But if you burn it, it tastes of nothing, because effectively active carbon is just carbon. It has no real flavor compounds in it. It's just a really good filter for getting rid of the stuff that you don't want, which is why the wine guys are less interested. So effectively what you're asking is, would we try and toast active carbon before we get to the wood? I don't think that would be too smart.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Like I said, it's a question that's been wrote.
It's all good.
The answer makes complete sense. And that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, you know what? Let me ask just to make sure. So
I think it's just in simple terms for a primary customer being a bourbon barrel, they have to be charred because that's the legal requirement. But you want to get the toasts really effective. So then you flash off the top with a little bit of char to more or less, depending on what your customer specification is. And then we can dial into that. And you sacrifice a little bit of toast, but you're still going to have a really healthy toast layer underneath, which is accessible via the cracks and alligator skin char that we put on top.
So, with the proliferation of toasted products, so specifically either an added toast or a within the first barrel or a second barrel finishing that's just using toasted and either lightly or not charred barrels. As I said, this is definitely a trend that's coming up in the bourbon industry. Can't say for how long, but in your guys' minds, is it more of a trend? Is it more of something that you think is going to be around for a while? What do you think is driving that?
I do not think it's a trend. I think there's a clear difference in the quality of the product that comes out when you do a double barrel, say, and a toasted double barrel. You're adding so much depth of flavor. You have a mature product that's already going to theoretically be good. By giving it a chance to pick up an extra boost in just those vanillins, caramels, mochas that you get in the toast, and it doesn't take a lot of time. You're immensely changing the product in a short amount of time. And I do, in my opinion, I think that it does make, and when done properly, it makes for a better product. So I don't think that it's necessarily a trend, because I do think that it actually has a tangible quality difference, as opposed to maybe a marketing ploy behind it, would be my take on it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's the experience of Scotch and Irish whiskey is that a lot of guys will be using new oak, toasted oak, etc., and they will finish for 2-3 months max, because the pickup of flavor and new oak is so quick and so rapid. It's incredible what it can do, and it really does give something, a nuance to the blend, really mature character, lots of mouthfeel, that type of thing. So for me, it's a really good way of investing in your liquid. and bringing something, and it gives the blenders and distillers more tools and more, you know, flavor palette to play with. So for me, I think it will only continue. And the consumers are becoming more educated about how their product is made and what they want from it. And I think that's certainly going to continue.
And one other thing, I think, you know, you mentioned that bourbon is, you're seeing this more and more with toasted finishes in bourbon. It's actually, it's happening quite a bit in Scotch and Irish whiskey as well. We're seeing it more and more. And I think it's very interesting. One, I think for one reason, I think it's for them to try to tap into the consumer base that is here in the States, where Scotch and Irish whiskey are tiny in comparison to what bourbon consumption is here. Globally, Scotch is huge, it dwarfs bourbon. But when you're in our little island here of North America, bourbon dominates everything. And so I think Scotch and Irish whiskey producers have realized that there's a big untapped customer base here. And if they can maybe create some sort of sense of familiarity in a Scotch or an Irish whiskey by finishing their product in a new American oak toasted barrel, you pick up all these kind of flavors that are familiar with bourbon drinkers, and you can kind of marry them into a Scotch or an Irish whiskey and create something that people in Kentucky who say, oh, I hate Scotch. Well, have you ever tried this Scotch though? And then they say, oh, you know what? This doesn't really taste like what I think Scotch tastes like. And all of a sudden you've just opened up this entire market of people that might be willing to experiment with something they would have never otherwise wanted to drink. Yeah.
So I know just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of, I think Balvenie and Ardbeg both did toasted finishes. Are there other,
Glenfiddich. There's that one as well. We were involved in the Glenfiddich and the Balvenie. Bushmills has just released one that we're involved in. So there's a few.
And more small craft producers always kind of pushing that envelope of experimentation.
I think key here, especially for, you know, Scotch and Irish, is that the rapid flavor pickup on a subtle spirit is really good. So it's a really quick way to add flavor and complexity to a product, and some of the smaller guys maybe want to get to that flavor profile quicker, obviously, you know 3 years rather than 12 years, so that's advantageous to them. But it really does bring sweet vanilla, you know, oaky, marzipan, toffee, those flavors really come through and are really popular, so it allows people to play and tweak with, you know, what they've got underneath.
Awesome. I know of the ones you mentioned, I have to think the Bushmills is the one that I have to pick up first. It's my favorite Irish whiskey. So
yeah, nice.
Go grab one of those.
Yeah, that's good.
And they've just done this big release. Lots of publicity behind it.
It just launched last week.
Yeah.
See if it's the benefit of being in New York. We pay a premium for it in price, but
yeah.
We usually get most of the releases that aren't either Kentucky only or
right. You know,
only in the home country.
Yeah.
So with, let's take the second barrel in, if you're doing a, you know, double barrel where the second barrel is just toasted, but not charred, you know, obviously used bourbon barrels, used charred barrels have been going back and forth for decades between here in Scotland and Ireland and everywhere. But when you have the barrel that's just toasted and used, what is the next life cycle of that barrel?
Martin, why don't you want to take a crack at this one?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's probably not something that's come to, you know, to the fore too much, because, you know, you're looking at probably, you know, limited number, how, you know, they're probably lost in a mass of traditional bourbon barrels, I would suggest. But it's never been, actually, I've never thought about it, to be honest. Yeah, it's quite a good question. So
that's why I asked you.
I did notice that, actually.
That was a beautiful handoff right there.
But you know, but they would likely end up in a wider population, and there's no issue in terms of, be a good barrel, obviously lack a bit of char, but at the same time, it wouldn't be in the volume that are moving across. It wouldn't be a problem. It'd just be without taking the ends out. How would you know unless they were marked up accordingly?
Yeah.
But the volume would be so low currently, I would suggest that they may get used one or two times, by the producer and see where it goes. But it's something I hadn't thought about, so it's a good question.
Yeah.
Some would go to the beer market, I think.
Yeah, no doubt.
Craft brewers that are wanting to do something cool are always looking for something different than just a normal bourbon barrel, because bourbon barrel aged beers are common. So, we get that question a lot, from breweries you buy bourbon barrel from, so I'll say, well, what other weird stuff do you have? But Martin's right. The volume now, because this trend or whatever we want to call it with toasted finishes, is so new, there's not really that many out yet. They're not coming back into the used market really yet.
The Whiskey Ring podcast is now brought to you by Mash and Grape. I'm a huge fan of Mash and Grape. They ship to most states nationwide. They have great private selections and a great membership program called the Dark Spirit Society, of which I'm a member, that gets you even more private selections plus free shipping on orders over $95 anywhere that they ship. For Whiskey and My Wedding Ring fans and Whiskey Ring podcast listeners, Mash and Grape is offering 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription, prepaid or ongoing. Just use code WhiskeyRing at checkout. That's mashandgrape.com. Search Mashbox Club and use code WhiskeyRing at checkout for 20% off your first month of any Mashbox subscription. The Whiskey Ring podcast is also brought to you by Cairn Craft. I use Cairn Craft's Cairn Caddy bamboo glassware carrier, the Cairn Caps bamboo lids, and Cairn Cradle glassware hanging racks every single day. And definitely when I'm tasting new things and have a lot of things to get through. Nobody else is making carriers for your Glencairns like Cairn Craft is. Plus, they've got infinity decanters, glass lids, Glencairn brushes, and more. Whiskey Ring podcast listeners can get 10% off their purchase with code WhiskeyRing10 at checkout. Just go to CairnCraft.com, pick any of those incredible products that I use on a daily basis, and use code WhiskeyRing10 at checkout for 10% off your purchase. Now, back to the episode.
From a technical perspective, I think the one analogy that I do have good insight on is the use of ex-red wine barrels in Scotch and Irish, and especially when the barrel market gets tight. A lot of those barrels go in. None of them are charred. And what they do, they produce amazing color and amazing flavor in the subsequent spirit, but they don't have any ability to reduce the sort of immature sulfury character that comes with new make spirit. So some distillers will use a process called dechar rechar on those, where they'll scrape the top surface and then reburn it. So they'll take off a little bit of toast and then reburn that to give themselves a char, just to change up that barrel. Others will just fill them regardless. And over time, we'll make sure they manage that stock so that there's not too much of it going forward from a blending perspective to allow too much immature sulfury notes to come through in the finished product.
So when you're obviously bourbon drinkers are, and I mean, Scotch and Irish, of course, too, but bourbon drinkers are probably very familiar with the levels of char that you're going for, like one char, 15-ish, 10, 15 seconds, but all the way to a five, the heavy char that Heaven Hill's doing right now with like, I think it's a minute and a half or something like that, or a little bit more. When you're talking levels of toasting, clearly what you're talking about is not seconds difference. It's, several minutes in between each layer. So, one, how do you guys manage that as the actual process unfolds? And also when a potential customer comes to you and says, we want to do a toasted barrel, but we're really not sure like how much we want it toasted. Walk me through what that kind of process would be like.
So that kind of comes back to your question of could we char on the toast first? So the idea is by toasting first, we're able to one, visually see what's happening and also smell what's happening. And so you're talking about probably five-ish minutes between varying toast levels on a spirit barrel. On a wine barrel, you could be talking 20 minutes difference. With wine, a wine barrel could be toasted for as long as an hour and a half, a single barrel. Obviously, when trying to make whiskey barrels
but from the perspective of economies of scale, you can't spend an hour and a half toasting a single whiskey barrel and make any money doing it. So we have ways that we can kind of concentrate the heat inside the barrel to get that toast level quicker. So what we're talking about is, you know, maybe 5 minutes for a light toast and up to 20 minutes for a heavier toast. And, but what we're looking at is we're using a visual kind of keys and the smell that's coming off the barrel to determine where we are on that toast spectrum.
All right, so I'm gonna shift gears a little bit. And I wanted to ask you about different woods that you might be using. And this is stepping away from the toasted specifically and, you know, asking about just in general.
Yeah.
You know, obviously American oak, that's the big boy out there that everyone wants to use, but I'm curious your experience with different woods, different oaks, and you know, what's going on with those now.
That's another hot topic.
I should know that Will had a great smile that just came up, like this very mischievous smile.
Yeah, because we've had some very recent experience. It's still a bit raw.
Yeah.
Working with non-oak species. It turns out we used American oak for a very good reason, that it doesn't leak if you treat it right. Other species aren't so accommodating. So we built some very expensive, maple and hickory sieves, essentially. You know, 53-gallon sieves that just would not hold no matter what we did. So yeah, we're always trying different stuff. You know, obviously we've worked with American oak. We've worked with, Chinkapin, Oregon oak, different regional variations. We've worked with French oak and European oak. And we brought in some Mizunara oak from Japan that we didn't build ourselves, but we worked with a cooperage over there that we know. So, you know, we do all different types of stuff, but the bread and butter is definitely Quercus alba, and it's for a very, very good reason, because it really, it holds tight and it imparts really desirable flavors. So there's a very good reason it has become, you know, far and away the predominant oak that we use.
I'm fascinated by the different, you know, woods being used. I'm a huge Mizunara fan, for example, even though I know it can leak, maybe not as much as you were saying, the maple and the hickory do, but.
No, not as much as that.
But it could certainly leak quite a bit. So going back to the larger view, when you're approaching, when you're using a Chinkapin oak or even a Mizunara barrel that's being brought over versus a white oak, do your core methods change when charring, when toasting?
No, the process for coopering is going to be the same. We're still going to be using our kind of key guiding principles, which is using our eyes and using our nose to be sure that barrel's being toasted and charred properly. And we're going to treat them the same way regardless of the species. The end result is going to be that whatever that species is going to give you whatever flavors it has to impart in comparison to what white oak would have to impart, but we'll treat them the same way.
Yeah. I think the key thing here is if you're going to invest time and effort and money in a different type of wood, my sense is always why you know, spend time and money like turning it into carbon when actually you want to preserve the flavor from that original wood. So you really want to treat it with, you know, with some care. So that's always my view on these type of projects, is how best to get there. And it really depends also on each distiller's view, what their new make spirit it looks like, and you know, they're trying to produce that consistently. Is it sulfury? Is it light? Is it fresh? Is it fruity? Is it, how does it perform? What are they trying to achieve in terms of a flavor map?
All right, so I'm going to shift, and I've thrown all over the place, but I'm going to shift gears again. So coopering as a craft, I'm, you know, curious on number one, just kind of a very basic history of it, because I'll be honest, I don't know a lot. I know that it's been there, but I don't really know, you know, how it came about or what advances have been made through it. So I wanted to ask just what, at the basics, like what coopering is, what it goes back to. And then after that, let's say you have someone new come to you, say, I want to work at Kelvin. I know zero about cooperage. I know zero about wood. But one day I want to be, you know, where you guys are sitting at the top of the rungs and with very deep knowledge, where do they go? So let me do the history of the coopering first, and then we'll go to the career path.
Yeah, the history, it's thousands of years old. You know, if you go back and look in kind of Celtic and Roman artifacts, you'll see examples of, you know, wooden vessels with shaped staves and the curve that we know today. So that technology has been around for thousands of years. A lot of it was also informed by shipbuilding, you know, bending wood to make a watertight vessel. A lot of the stuff from shipbuilding applies too. So there were coopers around throughout history. If you look at Scotland and Ireland, where it really took off, but you know, also all over Europe, there were coopers too. And they would be producing, you know, you have to remember that a huge variety of goods were shipped in barrels, you know, both liquids and non-liquids, you know, fish and nails and gunpowder, coffee, all sorts of stuff were shipped by barrels. So you needed coopers to be able to make those and maintain the ones that were already in circulation. So for example, the British Navy at the height of the empire, every Navy ship would have had a cooper on board to make sure that, you know, their water supply and their beer supply wasn't leaking all over the place. That also helped the spread of the industry as well to distant parts of the empire. But then when you get into kind of the 1800s and 1900s and kind of the explosion of, or the real popularity of mass produced beer, you think of the Guinness Brewery and the Bass Brewery, each would employ, you know, hundreds of coopers because all that beer was aging in small barrels. So it was traditionally a good trade to get into, but you know, it kind of the advent of the metal keg really affected that. So there was a dwindling of the coopers, but then the kind of the post-Second World War, as Scotland started bringing in bourbon barrels from the US, they needed people in Scotland. At that time, they'd bring them in bundles and ships. So they needed people to rise them up and reassemble them into barrels. And that was around the time my dad started doing it in the 1950s. It was a very good trade. It was a well-paid trade. It was hard work, but well-paid. So it was quite a desirable trade to get into. If you could get into it, you could find someone to take you on as an apprentice. So there you go, 2000 years of history in 4 minutes.
Good, and you ended with a perfect segue into the second question, which is, you know, what does it look like to become a cooper?
Yeah, well, here it's a bit different. In Scotland and Ireland, and probably in France, you would have to serve an official apprenticeship to get into the trade. Here, we don't have that kind of limitation. So we will bring people on, start them working on used barrels where they get to learn the hammer and driver and kind of the fundamentals of barrel repair. And if they show kind of interest beyond that, then they'll work their way up into the new barrel department. So it's a much less formal process here where it can be a matter of months as opposed to years if a person shows promise and willingness to put in the time.
There's also technology that exists now that changes the need for you to spend so much time learning maybe as much of the historical aspects of coopering that were required when you didn't have hydraulics and pneumatics and electric motors and things like that. You need to be able to build a barrel by hand. That is still commonly taught in the more traditional coopering areas like Scotland and Ireland, but I guess the question of how much of that is really needed
Yeah. And that's kind of the approach I think that we look at here in the States. It's like
a bit more pragmatic.
Right. It's we're here to keep barrels moving and keep it, you know, keep as many barrels in circulation and make as many new barrels as we possibly can. And using technology to benefit us is more of the driving factor. Because we have the technology, why not use it?
Sure. All right. Awesome. So I have one or two more questions, then I'll let you guys go for the day. I do want to say this has been, you know, again, it's the first Cooperage I've gotten to talk to on or off the podcast. So I am very excited, hence why my questions keep running quite long. So where, obviously you guys are, as you said, you're a very big supplier of particularly the craft whiskey industry. You deal with some big guys too, but is it a lot of craft ones or smaller distilleries, if you want to put it that way. What's your capacity to look like now, and are there plans to expand to meet more interest as just, you know, more and more distilleries keep popping up almost every day?
As at my age, I'm a bit younger, so I'm still I guess driven, and I have the desire to bring misery on myself, perhaps. I would always want to be looking at how to improve and expand and grow, but without sacrificing what we consider our key difference. And so there are limitations there. Making barrels the way that we make barrels, there's still very much an art to it. And I think that art is maybe dying in a lot of the other sort of cookie cutter auto plant type of cooperages out there that are just there to make as many barrels as they possibly can, which is needed for this industry as well. So it's kind of juggling those two things, quality and quantity, and we will never sacrifice quality for quantity. So that for me, that's always the dilemma, is how can we continue to tweak things and improve our efficiencies here, but without ever sacrificing what we consider to be our differentiating factor.
Awesome. I think, Martin, you look like you wanted to jump in at one point there.
No, I was just felt like William was making out that myself and Paul weren't driven anymore.
Yeah, I did notice that too, Martin. Thank you.
Yeah, I do know.
That was not what I
have to. I have to politely disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm not that old. Come on.
No, nor am I.
Maybe I feel like I'm more of a glutton for punishment than the two of them. They're wiser than me.
Wily veterans.
Yeah.
Life experience.
Yeah.
But, all right. Before we jeopardize his job any further,
we won't let him forget. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Add to the list.
Branded in. That's all right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you guys so much for coming on. I like I said, I've really enjoyed just learning about this. I know I have a bit more reading to do, more follow up. I'm hoping to reach out to you guys with some follow up questions if any.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, Ross. Absolutely. Yep.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, again, thank you guys. And before we end, where can people find you? Whether website, social media, anything?
Yeah.
KelvinCoopers.com. At Kelvin Cooper's on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah. And LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Give us a follow if you want any technical chat.
Awesome.
And
awesome.
We're always here to answer the phone.
Yeah.
Awesome. And as someone who reached out to, I'll be honest, I reached out to a couple of Cooperages that wanted to talk to somebody. You guys were the first and still the only to respond. So
very nice.
So that says something in many ways, and I'll let it speak for itself. But thank you guys again. Have a wonderful day. This has been another episode of the Whiskey Ring Podcast. Cheers, gents. I'll be following up soon. And
thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye. Bye.